You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. A federal judge recently found the New York City Police Force's stop-and-frisk practice unconstitutional and discriminatory. Detroit's stop-and-frisk policy is based on the same advice from consultants at the Manhattan Institute, who also advised New York City. Despite the judge's findings, Detroit Police Chief James Craig says the stop-and-frisk in Detroit will continue and that the police will adhere to the best policing practices as called for under a consent agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. MLive reported Chief Craig says anytime the police stop someone, it's documented and it's based on reasonable suspicion. The American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan has called on the Detroit police to end the practice. In a three-page letter, the ACLU called stop and frisk a prescription for an avoidable local disaster. Joining us now is Mark Fancher with the ACLU. Mark, let's start with the basics. What is stop and frisk?
Stop and frisk is actually a lawful police procedure. In 1968, the Supreme Court, in a case called Terry versus Ohio, ruled that when police officers have, as they term it, articulable facts, which would lead them to conclude that they have reasonable suspicion to believe that a crime is afoot, they have every right under the Constitution to stop an individual, to ask questions, and to otherwise determine whether crime is actually underway. If they also have reasonable suspicion that the individual is carrying a firearm, they have the right to frisk that individual and to determine whether, in fact, they have a weapon on their person. The problem with the practice as it was implemented in New York City is that the police officers were violating all of the guidelines that were laid out in the Terry versus Ohio opinion. Specifically with respect to reasonable suspicion, in the opinion, the court said that you can't base reasonable suspicion or say that you have it if you just have a hunch that the individual is engaged in crime or might be engaged in crime. But nevertheless, in New York, officers were told that a hunch was enough and that they could stop anyone just based on that level of suspicion. In addition, with respect to frisk, the officers were told that they had license to pat someone down, even if what they determined was, even if they determined that an object on the person probably was not shaped like a weapon or did not look like one, and if they patted them down and it felt like something other than a gun, then they could go in and try and search for it. And the specific example given was of an ink pen. They said that it's conceivable that a gun could be shaped like an ink pen. So we have not even talked about the instructions that they were given on race, but the court in New York concluded that these practices were so blatantly in contradiction with the guidelines laid out in Terry that they could not be upheld.
So we've heard the guidelines. We've heard what happened and went wrong in New York, except for the race factor, and we'll get to that. Walk us through a typical event in Detroit. How does it work in Detroit?
Well, that's something that we don't know. We only know that the police leadership claims that they comply with Terry. And, you know, if they do, then there is no basis for us or anyone else to object because that's the law of the land. But what does concern us is that they have engaged the Bratton Group and the Manhattan Institute to develop a stop-and-frisk program for their traffic control unit. And they are reported to be the organizations that developed the stop-and-frisk program in New York City that was found to be unconstitutional. So it troubles us that in the wake of an opinion which slams the practices in New York, that the Detroit police are still willing to have these organizations develop a stop-and-frisk program for their traffic control unit. And we've urged them strongly to abandon these groups and to look elsewhere for guidance in developing an approach for their traffic control unit.
Now, New York's stop and frisk was found unconstitutional in part because it disproportionately targets African Americans. Detroit is 88% African American, so it seems even random stops would end up being heavy on African American stops. Is there a difference between what was going on in New York and what is happening in Detroit?
Well, again, we don't know what is happening in Detroit. We only know what they say they plan to do in terms of developing a new stop and frisk approach for their traffic control unit. But with respect to race, the population, the demographics of a community really play no role in determining whether racial profiling is going on that's unconstitutional. You know, under the law as it exists, race can be a factor in determining whether it's appropriate to stop someone. So, for example, if there is a burglary suspect who's been observed by a witness and the description given of that suspect is that he's a black male, about 5 feet 5 inches tall, with a scar on his right cheek, and he walks with a limp. If a police officer, while he's undertaking surveillance of that neighborhood, spots an individual who's about 5 feet 5 inches tall, has a scar on his right cheek, walks with a limp, and happens to be black, then all of those things together provide him with reasonable suspicion, sufficient to stop him and to investigate and to find out if, in fact, this is the suspect. However, what that officer cannot do is to stop every black male that he sees simply because they are black. And that is precisely what the officers in New York were not only instructed to do, but which they were doing. And over the course of 8 years, they stopped more than 4.4 million people. And blacks and Latinos accounted for 83% of the people who were stopped. 88% of the people who were stopped were let go without citations or arrests. So that's the problem when you identify race as the sole factor. So it doesn't matter, even if you're in a community which has a population which is 100% black, if the only basis for stopping people is the fact that they happen to be of African descent, then that's unconstitutional. That's racial profiling. And it can happen as easily in Detroit as it can happen in any other community with a population which is very different.
I'm sure you've had discussions with people who feel that stop and frisk is a crime deterrent, that it helps reduce the crime rate. I wonder what your response is to that.
Well, I think the statistics speak for themselves. You know, in New York, they stopped 4.4 million people, and they let 88% of them go because they couldn't find anything or any reason to cite them or to arrest them. So how effective is that? I mean, what happens is that when you begin to base your stops solely on a person's color, then you end up stopping an awful lot of innocent people. And while you're spending time interrogating a lot of innocent people who are simply trying to go to work, pick up their kids from school, or maybe jog around the block to get some exercise, then the people who are committing crimes are able to operate unmolested, free to do whatever it is that they do without police watching them or looking at them. And that's the problem. So reasonable suspicion can be a good thing because it forces the police to really make a determination as to whether crime is actually afoot. And if they're undertaking that level of surveillance, you know, as opposed to a lazy approach, which is, well, this person happens to be black, this person happens to be Latino, let me stop them, they're going to be much more effective.
I want to note, I've read in some of the New York case reports that in some cases, yeah, people were stopped and they were ticketed or cited, but it wasn't because they were carrying a gun or because they fit the description of some crime. It's because they might have a bag with a little bit of pot in it or something like that. So it's not all major criminals that we're talking about who were arrested in this stop and frisk scheme in Detroit. So Chief James Craig indicates there might be some policy adjustments, but the practice would continue. What kind of adjustments can be made that would deal with the concerns you have about stop and frisk?
Well, the only thing that we're concerned with now, we just have two concerns. One, that they not listen to the Bratton Group and the Manhattan Institute because their approach has been discredited, and two, that they comply with Terry versus Ohio. If they do those things, we have no basis to complain about anything. So he has provided assurance with respect to to Terry versus Ohio, but we've heard nothing about their plans with respect to these consultants. And as long as they're on board, then we feel that there is a real risk of a problem. You know, he has implied, if not stated explicitly, that regardless of what is recommended to him, he plans to comply with the guidelines laid out by the court. But for us, that doesn't make very much sense, because if, in fact, you engage someone to provide you with advice and you pay them money to do that, and ultimately what you have to do is to make your own decisions about what kind of a stop-and-frisk approach you're going to pursue, it seems like money wasted and time wasted. And that's, you know, something that I'm not sure that the city of Detroit can afford during this time of great financial crisis.
Mark Fancher is the racial justice staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan. Thanks very much, Mark.
Thank you.